All right, we're in Mark chapter 4, beginning in verse 13. Then he said to them, Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all the parables? The sower sows the word. These are the ones along the path where the word is sown. When they hear, Satan immediately comes and takes away the word that is sown in them. And these are the ones sown on the rocky ground, ones who, when they hear the word, immediately receive it with joy. And they have no root in themselves, but endure for a while. And then when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. And others are the ones sown among thorns. They are those who hear the word, but the cares of the world, and the deceitfulness of riches, and the desires of other things enter in and choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. But those who are sown in good soil are the ones who hear the word, accept it, bear fruit, 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold. This is probably one of the most well-known parables that Jesus taught, mainly because he goes on to explain it. I think there's one other, probably in Matthew, with chapter 13, about the tares that he explains, or that is explained. But this one, he goes into detail to explain what these different things mean and puts the emphasis there. Notice that he sows the word. And how many people or who in the New Testament could you name that was converted without hearing the word? Can you think of one? There's not one, right? Why is that? Because they have to hear the word. It's one of the things that we have to do, is to hear it, to learn it, to understand what that word is. Notice how many times the word hear is used in this reading, even backing up to verse 12. May indeed hear in verse 14 or 15, when they hear in verse 16, when they hear in verse 18, those hear the word. In verse 20, the ones who hear. What is Jesus trying to get them to see and to understand is that in order for the word to go out, someone has to speak that word, and there are going to be different types of soil that that word comes in contact with. Now, not everyone, especially there in verse 15, not everyone heard Jesus. Why did they not hear Jesus according to verse 15? When I say hear Jesus, they may have heard the words, but they didn't pay attention to what the words meant and what they were saying to them, Jesus was saying to them. Why is it that not everyone heard Jesus? Satan. It's that simple. And what kind of ground is described there, verse 15? Well, it's the hard ground. It's the ground that the seed never even penetrates. It never even goes in, right? They have hard hearts, is how we would typically describe those. And those are people that just, and you've probably come across them at some point in your life. They just have no interest. They do not want to know. They don't care, right? One day they will, but in this case, they don't. And then we read about the rocky soil, and you know, maybe describe somebody that's you would consider the rocky soil. So, what happens when seed is planted in the rocky soil? What happens at first? It grows. You guys sure are shy this morning. No trick questions. So it grows, but when a little adversity comes, it withers, it goes away, and you've probably seen that, you know, maybe around your house. Maybe you've tried to do a garden, and if you've got rocks in your garden, and if you've ever tried to grow anything on top of the hill where we live, it's very hard because of all the rocks, right? It looks good there first, but something comes along, and it doesn't take very much at all, and it withers, it fades away. And that's one of the dangers of people that become attached to a congregation because of the people, and they aren't attached to Jesus, right? If they aren't converted to Jesus, then people are going to disappoint them. It could be that they're attached to somebody at a congregation, and that person, maybe they move, maybe job change, family requirements, something, they need to move, and now their support is gone, and they start fading away. Or it could be somebody in the congregation that does something wrong, that does something sinful, that leaves the Lord. And what happens to that? Well, they kind of fade away. They haven't put roots down deep. I used to know some farmers, but I don't know that many anymore. But I'm told that with corn, when you plant corn, obviously you need rain. But there is a point in that growth process that you can get too much rain. That there is a point where that corn needs to be stressed a little bit, needs to be good and dry, so that the roots of the corn will go down deeper because it's seeking that moisture, and so it will go down deeper. But if there's too much water at that time, it doesn't go down deep. It gets satisfied. It's just going to go as far as it has to go. It's just going to reach out a little bit. And then later on, when it really needs to be down deep, the roots aren't there. They didn't have to grow, so they didn't grow. And the corn either falls over in the storm, or when the drought does hit and it hits hard, then the roots aren't deep enough to pull that moisture out, and the corn just doesn't grow. Right? You can see that analogy, and you can see why Jesus used these examples, because there's things that they would have understood at the time, and we can understand even now. But then we see the ground, verses 18 and 19, that to me is possibly some of the scariest ground to be in, because what happens? You kind of get suffocated. And you could be suffocated by okay things, but if you're suffocated, you still die. You know, the reality is there's only 24 hours in a day. And the question is, what are you going to do with those 24 hours? You know, what are you going to be busy with? I was thinking about this. There's a project I'm working on, and I was trying to schedule some time to talk to a man that's an attorney, and we were setting up some time because I was needing to get his opinion on some things, and, you know, he said, yeah, you know, I'd love to talk to you, but what did he say? He said, I'm on the soccer, choir, theater, lacrosse carousel. Now, this is a Christian. And I'm not condemning him for that. I'm just thinking of an example that we're working together on a project, a benefit project, and he doesn't have time to work on those things. It's to help a charity to do some certain things, and he doesn't have time because he's tied up with all these things. Is there anything wrong with taking your children to soccer, choir practice, to theater, to lacrosse, football, baseball? Is anything wrong with that? When does it become wrong? And when it's choking out the word, when you get so busy on those things that you do it to the neglect of the most important things. One of the quotes I read says, don't give first-rate effort to second-rate causes. And there's a example in that was given. I assume it to be true, that it was given to Alexander the Great. Supposedly there was a man that would hone his skills to be able to throw a pea through a tiny hole. And he practiced and he practiced and he practiced and he practiced. And he got so good at it that he could just do it from almost anywhere in the room, and he could hit that target right through that little hole. And so he went before Alexander the Great and demonstrated his skills. You know, he had worked a long time on it, and it was pretty impressive. And so Alexander the Great said, "That is something special. And for your reward, here's a bushel of peas." Right? You got more peas. And what's the point of that? You can spend a lot of time getting really good at something. But if it's not of something of value, it means nothing, right? There's nothing wrong with having a hobby. There's nothing wrong with, you know, enjoying something. But when you do it at the expense of the most important things, that's when we get choked out. And that's the warning that's being given here. And finally, but those are sown in the good soil. You know, how can you tell when the seed has been sown in the good soil? What does it say? Bears fruit. See the produce. And it produces 30, 60, 100 fold. So it really does make a difference. Any thoughts, comments on that section? Yeah, and we'll get into that here in just a minute about the responsibility of sowing, but keep sowing. What Shane is saying is it doesn't say don't be so discouraged that you don't sow anymore. It's just realize you've got to keep sowing. You've got to keep putting that word out there. And Mark's going to say a little bit more about that here in just a minute. In verse 21 through 25, and he said to them, "Is a lamp bought, put in under a basket or under a bed or not on a stand? For nothing is hidden except to be made manifest, nor is anything secret except to come to light. If anyone has ears, let him hear." And he says to them, "Pay attention to what you hear. With the measure you use, it will be measured to you, and still more will be added to you. For to the one who has, more will be given, and from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away." All right, so when you buy a lamp, what do you do with it? Where do you put it? Put it on a stand. Why? Yeah. Why do you not put it under the bed? Yeah, it doesn't. Maybe if you're looking for something under the bed, it's useful for a moment, but it's useless there. It doesn't do what it should do, and that is to give light everywhere. Why is Jesus talking about a lamp? What? Light. How do we normally view this passage? What is it talking about? What's that? So you don't hide Jesus from other people. The light is supposed to shine. I can remember as a child, people talking about letting your light shine, being that light for other people. And I think that is true, but I'm not sure that's what the context here is really talking about when we look at it in context. And I hadn't thought about that. But what did he just talk about? He just talked about the word, right? Sowing the seed, putting the word out there. And then following that, what is he going to talk about? He's going to talk about seed, right, and how the seed grows. And then he's going to talk about the parable of the mustard seed. So you see he's talking about the word, the word, the word. Is he not talking about the word here? What are we supposed to do with that word? Supposed to share it, supposed to sow it. What are we supposed to do with the light here? We're supposed to let it shine. Do you let the light, in this case, if it's the word, do you let the word shine? How does that look? What am I talking about? Do you let it shine in your life? Do you let it have its purpose? What happens if you take the word and put it under your bed? You don't read it. You don't look at it. You don't study it. What happens? Makes as much sense putting the lamp under the bed, right? Why don't we study? So that we know, so that we're able to not only tell others, but for us and for us to learn and for us to grow and to know. In verse 24, it says, hear, pay attention. And again, that word hear is popping up yet again. And it says the effort or the measure shows in our learning. If we don't stay with it, we are going to lose it. You've heard that saying before, use it or lose it. Is that not what he's saying? For the one who has, more will be given, but the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. Study. Have you ever studied something in school and then you don't use it and then try to go back to it sometime later? What happens to that knowledge? It's probably there somewhere, maybe. And you really have to dust it off. You know, somebody asked you Pythagorean theorem. You know, there was a time I could tell you what that was. I kind of remember. I haven't used it in a long time, at least not knowingly. And so I learned it, I knew it, but then I haven't used it, and it doesn't mean what it used to mean to me, right? That's what happens to the Word. If we're not in the Word, if we're not using the Word, if we're not adding to our knowledge, then we're just kind of pushing it to the side. It's not that important. We're going to forget it, and it won't be there anymore. So use it or lose it. Any thoughts, comments on that section? Yeah, you can certainly see that you know, teachers respond to people that are eager to learn, right? Now, good teachers will work extra hard on those that are more resistant, but it's easy to teach people that want to learn. And when we want to learn God's word, we can. It may be easier for some than for others, but the reality is God's going to give the increase. Right, God's going to help those who want help and want to learn. He's made that promise, seek and you shall find. Tiffany?
Just in this little area too, you talk about the light and the lamp, and you know, what do lamps need to be able to work? They need electricity or oil or gas, something to make it run.
Fuel. Yeah, excellent. If you heard that, but you know, what does a lamp need? It needs a source of power, either oil or electricity or whatever. Just like a lamp needs that supply, we need a supply, and that comes from God's word. Austin?
I think this passage, along with the sower, when we're sitting with our neighbor and thinking about that, both of these together invite us to make a decision. How are we going to receive the word? And is it going how are we going to respond to it? And then his finishing point in that, in verse 24, paying attention in verse 25, no one leaves Jesus' words the same. We're either better
Very good. And again, and thanks for that little reminder that, you know, the context that we're looking at all this, or from the vantage point we're trying to look at all this, is how would I explain this to somebody that I'm studying with? What would I say? How would I, when I say use the passage, it's not that you're using the passage, you're just using what's there, but to use it to talk to somebody about their soul. Okay? All right. Let's look at 26 through 29. And he said, the kingdom of God is if a man should scatter seed on the ground. He sleeps and rises night and day, and the seed sprouts and grows. He knows not how. The earth produces it by itself. First the blade, then the ear, then the full grain of ear. When the grain is ripe, at once he puts the sickle, puts in the sickle, because the harvest has come. This particular parable is, I think, only found here in Mark. And it's talking about a man that plants a seed, goes to bed, and just lets nature take over, right? And we see a natural process. The seed goes in the ground. Some days later, a blade comes up. A little bit later, you see the plant. Then you see the produce come, and then they finally harvest it. We don't... What point do you think Mark is trying to make here? Well, Jesus is really trying to make here. What point is he making? I don't think he tries to make it. He makes it. What point is he making here? We may not understand. And I think there's another important thing he wants us to take away from this. What if we constantly said our job is? As Christians, what is our job to do with the word? To sow it. Is it our job to see, to make sure that that blade comes up? Is it our job to make sure that that blade turns into a plant? And that that plant has fruit on top of it of some sort?
We couldn't do that even if we tried.
We couldn't do it if we tried. No matter how hard we wanted to, we couldn't do it. And I think that's what Jesus is wanting us to see here. Our job is to sow the seed. He will give the increase. We don't have to understand how it works. I don't have to understand how God works in people's lives. I don't have to understand how the word impacts somebody's life, because your life and my life, even though we're on some common tracks, they're very different. I've had different life experiences. You've had different life experiences. But the word of God is powerful, and it's going to have its impact on all of our lives, no matter what. But we have to have it. He's talked about the different soils, the different hearts. But it's also a good reminder to us that our job is simply to sow the seed. We don't have to understand exactly how it all works. Any thoughts, comments about that one?
Talking this year, I'll even be preaching this morning about things that we want to think about as we go about that work, but I fear sometimes that we just forget where the power really is. Just the power of sitting and just reading the Bible with someone. You know, there's just great power in just letting the text do what the text does that you and I can't do.
Yeah, I think in our society we're, you know, it's so easy to go to YouTube and find out all the explanations of something, or the internet, and you can read the history of whatever. We feel like we need to be the internet for reading the Bible to someone. And there's no better text to read than the text itself. Yes, there may be some points where somebody would value some commentary on, you know, why, maybe given some history or how it fits or that sort of thing. And that's certainly appropriate. But the power is in the word, and I think sometimes we do forget that. I know I do. All right, verses 30 through 33. And he said, with what can we compare the kingdom of God? Or what parable shall we use for it? It's like a grain of mustard seed, which, when sown in the ground, is smallest of all the seeds on the earth. Yet when it's sown, it grows up and becomes larger than all the garden plants and puts out large branches so that the birds of the air can make nests in its shades. With many such parables, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. And he did not speak to them without a parable, but privately to his own disciples, he explained everything. If you look in your Bible and look at the period there at the end of one of those sentences, a mustard seed is just a little bit larger than that. So that gives you an idea of the size that we're talking about. And then it describes how it grows. What is Jesus' point in this? What's he trying to get us to understand? Power of the seed. What else might he be getting us to understand? Brian? Yeah, he's going to make it happen. He's in control. Any other thoughts? Go ahead, Dave. Just take that little spark. Steve? God can turn a little into a lot. Yeah. And I think that's the point of this, is we sometimes think it takes this grand effort. We think it takes this whole big process. And the reality is God can use us, even in small doses or in small amounts, to do big things. Right? That the power's not in us, it's the power's in the Word, the power's in Him. He gives the increase. And so it's important for us to remember that. You never know what small thing you may be planting that will grow somewhere. And you may never see the result of that. You may go your entire life, but there may be a seed that you plant or have planted in somebody's life, and at some point that takes root and they grow and they listen to what the Lord has to say. We may not even see it. But what I do know is if I don't sow that, if I don't share it, it's never going to grow. I told you this story before, and it's embarrassing to me, but I'm going to tell it again anyway. A few years ago, I was in the bookstore looking around, and I had told myself that I wanted to try to set up a study with somebody, at least, you know, offer that. And so I went to the religious section of the bookstore, and there was a guy there, had tattoos down both arms, and this was a time that wasn't as prevalent. And, you know, and so I'm thinking, okay, now here's my chance, what am I going to do? And I kind of walked around, and I lost my nerve. You know, the guy was looking at a book, and there in the religious section, I thought, you know, he's looking. And I didn't. I let him walk away. Could I have made a difference? I don't know. Did I make a difference? Absolutely not. Because I didn't say anything. I had the chance. As a man is looking for something, he may have had his mind made up already. It may not have made a bit of difference. I don't know, and I will never know, because I didn't say anything. That's what he's trying to get us to see. It's not in us. Yes, he will use us, but it's our job to give people the opportunity. That's what we want to do, is give the opportunity. And that's what he's showing here, is that God will take small things and make them great things, even when we don't understand how it all works. Any questions, comments over that section? All right. Now we see a little bit of a switch, as Mark does. Verse 35 through 41. On that day, when evening came, he said to them, "Let's go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a cushion. And they woke him and said, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Jesus, obviously here on the Sea of Galilee, the disciples are with him. A terrible storm comes up, and what do we find Jesus doing? Sleep. To my knowledge, this is the only passage that talks about Jesus ever sleeping. We know that he did. He was human. He would sleep. But very specifically, it says he's asleep. Does that seem like an odd time to you to sleep? I get seasick, so I don't think I might be asleep from that just because I couldn't stand it anymore. But here Jesus is sleeping. And the disciples almost seem aggravated with him, right? "Do you not care that we are perishing?" What had they seen at this point? What had they seen Jesus do at this point? Can you name some of the things? Demons driven out. Healing, right? The man with the withered hand, the lame man we just talked about. So why would they be aggravated at Jesus? Do you not care that we're going to perish? Lack of faith in that moment. What was Jesus' reaction? They wake him up. What does Jesus do? Yeah, peace be still. Now, when a storm passes on the sea today, normally what are the seas like, even after the storm passes? They're pretty rough, right? For days, because the storm has, and the wind has caused a lot of turmoil in the water, and you've heard rough seas, and that's because the storm has come through, and even after the storm's gone, it's still going to be rough. But what do we see here? Calm. Perfectly calm, right? What is the difference between verse 38, they're thinking they're perishing, in verse 39, at the end of verse 39, where it's calm. What's the difference? What's that? You had panic, turmoil, instant calm. What happened in between there? Jesus' words. Jesus' words are what made the difference. They provided that calm. Now, it's easy for us to see this story and for us to say, those disciples, man, if I had seen what they had seen, I got it recorded so I can't use that as an excuse, but if I'd seen it, you know, if I had witnessed it firsthand, how do you react when there's a storm in your life? Jesus, now I've seen him handle other storms, but he's not going to handle this one because this is my storm, right? Is that how we look at it? Is that how we think about it? That, oh, this is a bad one. This is a hard one. This is a difficult one. This is one nobody else has ever been through. Probably not true, but we certainly feel that way at times. Jesus is doing what comes natural to him, providing this peace for the disciples. Why did they react the way that they did? It says they were filled with great fear. We'd already talked about the miracles they had seen. They knew he was from God. Why on this occasion did they have fear and say, who then is this? Even the winds obey him. Seas obey him.
They're beginning to understand they're in the presence of God himself.
They're in the presence of God himself. Think about a couple of other times. Really one time in particular. There was a man named Jonah, right? And if you remember, the storm was raging. The seas had jettisoned everything out of the boat, and then they were going to cast lots to see, okay, who's going to be thrown over? And Jonah said, it's me. And they throw Jonah over, and what happens? It's calm. Who calmed the sea? God. It wasn't Jonah, but it was God. God calmed the sea. They would have known that. At the time of Moses, really not a calming of the sea, but taming of the sea, when it came to go through on dry land, what did God do? He caused the water to stack up, right? God controlled the sea. They knew that. They knew who controlled the sea. They'd never seen anything like that before. Nowhere else had anybody controlled the sea. They knew it was God. And then Jesus just simply says, peace be still. And it gets quiet. Sometimes we don't realize how impactful that is. Let me tell you just a quick story. I used to work at a chicken farm. And one night we were loading eggs, and the guy I worked with was somewhat superstitious, and he was talking about his aunt that had been murdered. They thought had been murdered, and talked about that whole story. So, you know, we're in high school, and you get kind of nervous and uptight. And this chicken house is 450 feet long, probably 40,000 chickens in there. And it went dead silent. Lights were on, it went dead silent. And all the chickens went, ooh, together. So two high school boys were loading eggs, and we loaded eggs fast. We wanted to get out. That was a really freaky thing. I don't know, the wind blew, and the chickens did whatever chickens do. But in our mind, it's like, whoa, what just happened? It's out of the ordinary, and you're just kind of like, whoa. It was silent. That silence just startles you. Can you imagine being in a storm like this? The water is coming in the boat, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's quiet. It gets your attention. Got their attention. And it made them think, who is this man? It's Jesus. Okay? Thoughts, comments about that section? All right, let's get into chapter 5. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs. He was one, no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was crying out and cutting himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, what have we to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me. For he was saying to him, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. And Jesus asked him, what is your name? And he replied, my name is Legion, for we are many. And he begged him earnestly not to send him out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. They begged him, saying, "Send us into the pigs, let us enter them." And so he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herds, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. So this is one of the, I guess, stranger stories about demons and pig possession. But Jesus has gone to the other side of the sea. It's a part of this, an area that had been less friendly to Jesus. We don't see him there a lot of the time. But what is this man like? How does it describe him? Be very strong, seeming like superhuman strength. The chains couldn't bind him. He'd break the fetters, and then he was wild, screaming and cutting himself and doing all these things. People were clearly afraid of him. Jesus is just getting out of the boat, and this man comes to Jesus. Why is he rushing up to Jesus? There in verse 6. Man wants to be free. But here, they rush up to Jesus. And what are they begging for? They're begging for mercy. Don't torment us, there in verse 7. Crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What do you have to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." All right. Then they ask a seemingly strange question there in verse 10. He begged him earnestly not to send him out of the country. When you think of demon possession, do you think of it as being geographic? Don't send us out of the country. That give us some clues, maybe, about Satan. Maybe challenge your thoughts about Satan. In Luke chapter 8, there's a parallel passage to this story. It gives us a little bit more clue there in verse 31. Don't send us into the abyss or the pit, basically to hell. Don't send us there. How did they know about that? Had they been there before? Matthew chapter 25, verse 41, hell is a place that's prepared for Satan and his angels. These demons are pleading to go anywhere but there. Somehow we have created in our minds that Satan is standing in hell and he's just so happy to be there and he can't wait to get you there. And it's just an ideal place for such an evil thing. And that is not the picture the Bible paints at all. It is not a place Satan is going to want to be. That is where he will be, but that's not where he wants to be. That's not where these demons want to be. They want to be anywhere but there. So that should tell us something, too. We want to be anywhere but there. Time's getting away from me, so I'm going to stop there. Lord willing, we'll pick up and finish that story, but be thinking about why would Jesus grant their request? Demon asks Jesus something, and he says yes. Why would he do that? Thank you.